This is John England. I'm here interviewing, could you please say your name?
Joan McGregor.
And today is July 12th, 2016. And we're here in Flagstaff. And Joan, if you could please tell me when and where you were born.
I was born in Seattle, Washington. I don't know when.
You don't have to if you don't want to.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, disclose my age.
That's fine. Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and sort of the community?
Okay. Okay, I was born in Seattle. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. So my parents moved there when I was 6 months old. So pretty much grew up in that. In the Bay Area, which is known to be, next to, very good agricultural lands and farms and so on. So we used to go out on the weekend to Half Moon Bay and buy farm food.
Oh, great. And how long did you live there? How long did you grow up there?
I guess I lived there, pretty much, through secondary school, and then went to a number of places, and then eventually ended up at UC Davis to do my undergraduate degree in philosophy.
Perfect. Yeah, that's the next question. Maybe you could tell me a little bit more about your schooling and your education, both your pre-college years and then...
Okay.
Secondary education.
Well, let's see. So my primary years were, as I say, we lived down the peninsula. We lived in Belmont and then in San Mateo. Went to school there. I guess, one of the things that I often remember about going to school is that for some reason, I guess for a variety of reasons, my dad in particular was very militant about food and didn't believe in buying any kind of processed food, including, and I grew up, of course, in the 60s and 70s when it was a sort of heyday of white bread, Wonder Bread, TV dinners. The sort of whole processed food was just emerging, and it was really thought at that time, or now I think back on it, but it was sort of the middle class way to eat. So when I was a kid, we were never allowed to have white bread and or any sugar. My dad at that time when I was a kid used to say that sugar was worse than heroin, and I always remember thinking, I don't know what heroin is, but it must be pretty bad.
Wow. Where if I could ask real quick, where do you think that militancy came from?
He had been a gymnast and a bodybuilder back in the in the 30s and 40s, and he grew up during the Depression when there wasn't a lot of food around, and his family always had a little garden in the backyard where they grew food, and I think he just got on to seeing food as really central to health and the sort of mind body spirit idea of the role of food in your life. So it wasn't as if this is in the Bay Area way before all the kind. This is not the foodie revolution now, but this, I say this is more early 60s, and where it was just it was really unheard of that people wouldn't eat white bread or wouldn't eat various kinds of processed food. So because that was really what was. That was the heyday of that food, right? It was really the development was in the 60s and 70s. And I think my dad, probably because of the, being a weightlifter, being a gymnast, seeing sort of, and then also seeing, he always talked about in the Depression how many people didn't have enough or access to good food. And I remember him talking about one of his good friends who... you know, his family didn't have enough food. I mean, a lot of people didn't at that time. And he got the kids all got rickets and, you know, really became very sick. And those kinds of health conditions lasted, you know, well into their, you know, later lives, right? So I think seeing that experience of people not, you know, not having access to any food or having access to, you know, just very poor quality food, you know, made him very aware of you know, eating good food. So even, you know, my mother talks about that, even though my parents didn't necessarily have a happy marriage. They got divorced, but she always said the one good thing about my father was he really was insistent that we didn't eat, you know, canned or frozen vegetables. We would always get fresh vegetables and, you know, fresh food. Yeah. And so that was, so that kind of formed, my thinking about, you know, food. And then, you know, I come from a family, though, you know, there's no reason, you know, other than eating real food and eating good food, that everybody's, you know, pretty much lived very long lives that aren't without health problems, you know, without significant health problems, you know. So, you know, I always like to tell the story of my grandfather, my dad's father. I mean, you know, he was from the north of England, and you know, his family was so poor. I mean, they. And then the father died, and he, you know, he ended up when he was 8 working in the mines, you know, the coal mines before they came to Canada. All these guys, so there was no opportunity, so they, you know, came and you know like in 1911 or something like that, they came over and you know, but even though, you know, he had that kind of really, you know, pretty deficient upbringing and having to work in the mines as a little kid, he lived to 101.
Wow.
But you know, they always ate good food. I mean, mm-hmm. and again, not sort of fancy food, but just they had a garden in the backyard where they grew food, they always had, you know, fresh bread that was, you know, whole wheat bread and those kind of things. So again, not a fancy diet,
right.
but just real fresh whole food.
Yeah, great. So I know this was kind of a young age, but did you get a sense that your father's idea of food was a common idea?
No.
Right.
No, not at all. In fact, when we went to school, all the other kids had, you know, white bread sandwiches with, you know, American cheese, mm-hmm. and, you know, ding dongs, that was the beginning of that, you know, the sort of, you know, all those packaged pastries, right, from Hostess, right. And potato chips,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I guess kids at that point still didn't have soda at school, but they're, you know, people would be able to drink soda. We were never allowed to drink soda. So, yeah, so, you know, I mean, not to say we didn't drink it, you know, and we were out and about, but, mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that was not a common. I knew that wasn't common because other people were. On the other hand, you know, in the Bay Area, there, you know, some of my closest friends growing up, our neighbors, and some of my closest friends were Chinese ancestry, and I learned a lot about food from them because they really focused on, again, fresh food, you know, made at home, and even though they were, you know, these are all sort of professional people, but they really, you know, paid a lot of attention to food, and in fact, they used to call me their white daughter because I would go, like I was just part of their family, and
right.
we would go to Chinatown on Sunday night and have dinner, and they always said, don't ask what it is, just try it, you know. And there were some pretty far out things that I ate as a kid.
Wow, that's great. So that's great. That ties into the next question beautifully, because I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what your fondest food memory is. It's a little bit more of a specific question, but maybe you could tell us what that was and why that was.
Oh, well, that's okay. Wow, that's hard. Yeah, I have a lot of, I might say, you know, just when I travel, you know, we travel a lot, you know, for fun and professionally, I guess, too. But, and then, you know, one of the joys of traveling is eating good food. And I remember when we were in Oaxaca, Mexico, we took a class at this restaurant, and the woman who runs it, the chef who taught us, was also, I think, the chef that taught Rick Bayless. I'm forgetting the name of her restaurant, but it was really great because you spend the whole day, including going to the market and cooking as a group, and learning about the ingredients and learning about the cultural history behind them, and just working with other people and laughing, and then at the end you sit down and eat this big meal you've created, mm-hmm. and that was a great memory. And I've done similar things like that in other countries, and find it's like a really fun way to get into a place.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Food as a place is that's an interesting idea. Thank you. So as you grew up, you started to get into food sustainability, this idea of food sustainability. Could you tell us a little bit about what led to that and how you got into it?
Well, I think I didn't really put the food and sustainability together until just pretty recently, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've been interested for a number of years on issues of sustainability, thinking about sustainability, and in particular, since I'm a philosopher, thinking about the ethics of sustainability. I mean, why should we care about the future? And so sort of trying to build out, what are our moral obligations to the future? And I've, come to see it as, a more complicated story. But anyway, so I was interested in that. I was also interested in bioethics. So I'm interested in human health. I'm interested in our health systems. And so what was it, sort of, in thinking about sustainability, I thought about the issues around climate change. And then climate change is kind of hard to get people very worked up about, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
So people don't really necessarily, they don't see it, we don't think we're experiencing it. And of course, we may not even experience the worst of it, in some of the, some regions. Maybe Arizona is going to be hotter and drier, but a lot of us have enough money, we can probably buffer ourselves from some of the worst of it.
Right.
So how do you get people to kind of care about these issues? And so that's where I started to think, well, rather than coming at climate, why not come at it through food, right? And of course, then once I started thinking about food as a sustainability problem, I started thinking about all the ethical issues around food that aren't necessarily sustainability issues, but when you think about sustainability in a broader context, they are. So social justice issues and cultural sustainability and so on, right? So that's a kind of roundabout way of getting to it.
Okay. So I read that your background is in ethics and social justice. Is that so? Is it fair to say that that kind of led into?
Yeah. I mean, it's it turns out that food has all kinds of ethical issues attached to it, right? We're now a lot of discussion about the some of the climate or the ecological issues around food have to do with the carbon footprint, for example, around the modern industrial ag, right? It's it's one of the biggest drivers, in fact, of climate change, right? So if we changed our agricultural practices, we could go a long way towards solving that problem, right? But then there are all sorts of other issues. I mean, there's a lot of discussion now about food deserts, right? So people in America, and that's the other thing, is when you start looking at social justice and food in America, I mean, we're the, we're the wealthiest country in the world. We produce more food than people in the world. In fact, we have so many calories, I think we have twice as many calories as every person in America needs. But we still have places, we still have people that go hungry in America. We still have, nutritional deficiencies, even if they have enough calories, or too many calories is what we're finding. But they're eating food that's, bereft of nutritional value, right? So, and sometimes that's because they live in a community that's a food desert, right? So they live in a community in which there's no grocery store that sells produce or sells dairy products or sells. So they might just live near some place that sells alcohol and soda, right? I mean, it's the 7-Eleven or it's the so there's a, what I came to is I thought, wow, food is a kind of lens in on a lot of ethical issues that I'm interested in.
Great. So you use a term called food desert.
Yes.
And which is, from my understanding, sort of an area that doesn't have, like you said, access to healthy or healthier foods.
Right.
Could you say a little bit more about that, like where they can be found? Are they sort of an inner city thing, or can they also be found in rural communities?
Yeah, so food desert, you know, I mean, I think it, you know, it originally people started noticing it in inner cities when, you know, grocery stores were no longer, well, you know, back in, you know, when they used to have sort of small corner grocery stores, you know, those went away. We went to larger grocery stores, but they're not situated in urban centers where there are poor people, right? So you'll have places, and I'm not sure what the technical definition of, but the point is that people can't, within easy access, walking or even a, you know, a short drive or bus ride, access a kind of major grocery store, right? And so there might be fast food joints, right? So there may be a Burger King, and there may be a 7-Eleven, you know, that sells candy bars, but the idea of a food desert is that it's bereft of access to good food. Now, I mean, good point about, you know, is it just in urban areas? No. I mean, one of the things they're finding is that, you know, like we look at Navajo Nation here and some of and other, you know, non-Indian country as well, where people don't have access, you know, again, for miles and miles and miles for any kind of healthy foods, you know, produce, and so they might have, you know, a convenience market, but convenience markets, as we all know, you know, are loaded up with potato chips, candy bars, and you know, so so that they're now mapping this. So it's kind of interesting because you can look at like GIS mapping. They're mapping food deserts in America, and you know, and there's a whole issue of why did this happen, and a lot of it has, you know, at least in the cities, has to do with certain kinds of, you know, redlining and sort of forcing minority people into certain areas and white flight to suburb. So there is a history there, right, how this happened. I'm not a historian, but I do know there's, I mean, it's an interesting question of sort of why did this happen and how do we solve it, right? How do we make sure that if we see something like food as a kind of basic right, healthy food, as a kind of basic right, how do we ensure that people all have access to it, right?
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
So the next question has to do with you and sustainable food systems. But if you could just explain what a food system is briefly.
Okay. So, I mean, a food system is, you know, is this complex of, you know, everything from, you know, farmers to distributors to restaurateurs to, you know, all those points within that food moves, all the way back to waste, right? How, what we do with food waste, right? Which is another problem, right? And, you know, because we have landfills filled with food waste because we waste 40% of our food. So a food system is just this whole, you know, system of all the ways in which we kind of input to output of food. Okay. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's kind of a complex, you know, set of issues. I mean, we often focus in on farmers, but farmers work within the farm bill, for example, or certain lending practices, or certain, so it's not just farmers doing their thing, they do it within a whole set of structures, right? And so when we want to think about the food system, we have to think about it in that more, I mean, if we want to, you know, if we think there are problems with it, we have to kind of recognize that it's a network of issues.
Okay, great. So this next question sort of, it ties in a little bit to the questions that we've asked before, but how did you become interested in sustainable food systems specifically?
Okay, so I became interested in sustainable food systems by seeing you know, for, I mean, kind of centrally how food impacts the environment. So if we want to worry about our effect on the, you know, the natural environment currently and for future generations, then we need to look at our food system. We need to look at how agriculture is conducted and how that whole system works, right? Right now we've got, you know, for example, incentives to, you know, big ag, and that's often working against smaller, say, organic producers who might be better for, say, ecological reasons if we invested in them rather than investing in big agriculture.
Right.
So, yeah.
So was there some a specific catalyst that got you involved in this or a specific idea? Or?
Well, okay, so I guess, okay. So I was part of a group that the IHR organized. They got a Mellon grant that was to look at the humanities contribution to the problems of the Anthropocene, right?
Okay.
So we all know what this idea, maybe we don't know, but it's a problem of the Anthropocene.
Right.
And rather than seeing the problems of the Anthropocene as a kind of science or engineering problem, humanists have been arguing that, no, these are really problems that people in the humanities need to be part of, thinking mm-hmm. about and working on solutions. So I was part of that group, and with that group, a group of us out of that started thinking about, rather than thinking about it sort of at abstract level, about taking the problem of food and saying, what can humanity say about the problem of our food system, which is, as I say, is a big contributor to the problems of the Anthropocene.
Right, okay, great. So this is all based on the idea of food sustainability. And maybe could you explain what food sustainability means to you?
Okay, well, food sustainability means to me, I've thought about it in terms of five different values. Maybe that's too complicated. Yeah.
No, that's all right.
Okay,
all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's only academics break things. Yeah,
sure.
A complicated system. No. Anyway, I mean, part of it is, I mean, I've been thinking about this, and also I work with this group on it, and so what we came to is that there are different values that we want to preserve if we want a sustainable food system. And so in thinking about that, we articulated these five values. So and what we mean by that is, if you want to build a sustainable food system in your community, what are the things that you should be paying attention to? What are the values you want to preserve? And again, partly is to get people to recognize that our system, you know, who we support, who we don't support, who gets food, who doesn't. I mean, those represent values of ours, right? We can articulate those values and change the system based on it, right? Just as we've made other changes in society, right? We decided that we didn't want to, you know, necessarily, you know, pollute our air, and so we put regulations in place, and we, you know, so we can change our behavior if we decide something's is a particular value of ours, right?
Right.
So what I the values that I think are important for a sustainable food system are, first of all, that your food system preserve the historical and cultural traditions of a place, right?
Okay.
So that that food is more than just energy, that it's really is about meaning in people's lives, right?
Right?
And it's tied up with their culture, their history, and that isn't static, that changes. So, you know, I mean, those of us who come to, you know, say to Phoenix, and maybe we were from back east or something, or maybe, you know, but suddenly, you know, you live here for a while, and then, you know, sort of Mexican food and some maybe indigenous ingredients start to filter into your cooking or other, but that those kinds of foods resonate in this place, right?
Right.
And there's a reason for that, because they grow well here and they make sense in this climate. So
right.
The idea that if you want a sustainable food system, it's also about sustaining culture, right? So
okay.
culture is part of sustainability. And that, again, that's why I think when sometimes people frame sustainability as just a kind of science problem, they're not recognizing that people don't want to just sustain the world. They want to sustain their traditions, their right. culture, right? So it's mm-hmm. cultural sustainability is important. So that's the first value. And the second value of a sustainable food system is maybe the more obvious one is ensuring that the food system, ensures ecological integrity, right?
Okay.
Right now, you know, we have food practices that are we're losing our soil. We're killing our bees,
right,
our pollinators, right? We're doing these things. That's not, it's not sustainable.
Right.
Right. If we don't have bees, we're not going to have pollinators. I mean, so some mm-hmm. of these things are just not sustainable. And people have been, you know, saying it, and there are changes here and there, but we need to think about it. And then if we look at here in the Southwest, and in particular in Arizona, where we have limited amount of water, and water is tied to energy because we have to pump it. I mean, all those things, we have to think about what should we be growing here, and you know, and what shouldn't we, right?
Right.
And so we have practices in the Valley and in Arizona. Well, this story came out about the Saudis owning, you know, big farms out west where they were. When they bought the land, they bought mm-hmm. the water rights, and they're growing alfalfa, that they send the alfalfa to Saudi Arabia to feed their cows so they have milk.
Oh, wow.
Right. Now, does that sound like a sustainable practice? You know, we don't have a lot of water. Alfalfa right. is a big water sucker, but also that alfalfa is not staying,
right.
you know, here, you know, either.
To, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, and so you've got the carbon footprint of taking it over there. And so there's a, so, sure. so that doesn't seem like a good practice. So we just need to think about those things, right?
Yeah.
And that goes to water rights. It goes to, you know, what should be practiced in certain areas, right?
Right.
So that's the second value. The third value is, practices that cultivate and sustain health, human health, right? So,
right.
So if we think about, you know, wanting to have a sustainable food system, we want one that, you know, really does, encourage healthy habits and health in humans, right? So
right.
again, we have these problems of, we have communities in Phoenix that have 50% diabetes, type 2 diabetes in their children.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So in many of the Indian communities and the Latino communities, and in white communities, but in some of those communities, it's devastating the kind of impact, and that is related to food.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's like there's not, you know, somebody's not putting something in the water, that it's related to our food system, and also lack of, you know, maybe access to good exercise and stuff, but really food is a big driver in the diabetes problem. So,
right.
so we've got a food system where we're making it cheap for people to eat, you know, empty calories, and then which results in these kinds of health problems. So that seems
sure.
to me another value is designing a food system that really, you know, encourages and preserves human health. A fourth value is food justice and social justice. So, you know, a sustainable system has to be one in which, you know, people have access to food. So we talk about food deserts, and then
right.
people who, you know, many people go hungry every day in America. A surprising number of them, more than most people are aware of. Yeah. A lot of kids, you know, are on free lunch, and often that's the only meal they get every day. There are schools yeah. that actually give kids, you know, bags of food at the end of the on Friday to take home for the weekend because they know they won't have any food at home. So,
right.
I mean, we have, you know, that shouldn't happen in this country, right?
Right.
And so thinking about that issue is an important one, but also thinking about social justice system issues in workers throughout the system. So when we think of farm workers, you know, having not only a living wage, but also not being, you know, living in an environment where pesticides are dumped on them and their kids,
right?
And then we've all heard some of the horrors of workers in the meatpacking industry, you know, the dangers involved in that, and, you know, and also the exploitation of those people. So sort of throughout the system, it's like we should have a system where this is about our food, but we want to make sure people in the food system are treated decently. And I would put in there as well that that system treats animals in a humane and caring way. I mean, sure. It seems to me if we're going to, you know, if we want to use animals for our food system, we should, you know, demand that it also live up to our standards of what decent treatment for animals and humane treatment. I mean, right now we sort of segregate out. We have our how we treat pets, which we, you know, and then we have, and then excluded from that kind of cruel treatment is farm animals. And that, you know, I think it's just been easy for people not to sort of, you know, turn a blind eye, but from a values point of view, that seems like not a good idea.
Right. Great.
Do you want to hear about my last value?
Yes, please.
I know you're probably going, oh my God.
I was just counting in my head. I think that's four. One more.
Okay. This is a lecture on food.
No, this is great stuff. Thank you.
Anyway, so the fifth value is this idea of food sovereignty, which is a bit of a buzzword, so I was a little worried about using that term.
Right.
I mean, it's being used in different kinds of contexts, and it does mean slightly different things. What I mean by it is that rather than just having a kind of the right outcome or the just outcome or the good outcome, that people have a say in the process. So that the food system is, right now I think a lot of people feel sort of helpless in our food system. They send their kids to school and the kids eat crappy stuff at lunch and then, you know, the TV sells their kids more stuff and then they can't, you know, you find out, somebody was just telling me the other day, there's sawdust in our Parmesan cheese, and there's all these things that you find that they don't have to label, right?
Right.
Somebody told me also that some cheap red wine puts red dye in it, you know. So there's a way in which our system is not transparent, and people don't have a sense, they don't feel like they're in control.
Right.
So for me, it's about participatory justice or participatory, being able to participate in the process, have a say in the system, have a say in what goes on, and have a right to transparency, right?
Great.
And this is, you know, we've all heard about the labeling issue with GMOs. It seems like there's a, you know, a labeling issue about everything. Why shouldn't we be able to know what's in our food?
Right.
I mean, you would assume that just as what's in it is what you think was in it, but we've found out that's not always true. So I do think that final value is that all of us care about being able to kind of control, you know, what happens to us and our family and our communities. And right now there's often a sense that these big corporations are kind of controlling it, and that's not to make them out to be evil, the evil demons, but the point is there is a sense in which there are kind of closed room doors deals being done in Congress, and it's not always working out for the advantage of people.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. And so I think it's fair to say then that sustainability goes beyond just conservation. When you first hear the word sustainability, there's sort of a tendency to think conservation or preservation. Maybe you could say a little bit more about what that means.
Good. Yeah, and I think that's a good point, that conservation isn't just about kind of preserving or conserving natural systems. I mean, this is one of the sort of debates that's, you know, has gone on and maybe is still going on to some degree, is, you know, whether or not, you know, humans are part of nature or humans are not part of nature. I come down on the, look, humans are part of nature. And so if we're conserving or preserving natural systems, we better preserve them with us in it, because we don't have any place to go. You know? And I also think that other view of that we take humans out of environments. Now, that's not to say that I'm certainly in favor of preserving wilderness areas and so on, but I also think that what we need to spend a lot of our ethical, you know, kind of brain power and time thinking about is built environments, including agricultural environments, and recognize that we're preserving them with us in it. And so it seems to me sustainability is not just about sustaining ecosystems, but is sustaining ecosystems with us in it. and of course us in it, that we are cultural beings, right? And we right. want to preserve and sustain our cultures, our values, right?
Right.
And so one of the things that we try to do is pass on to the next generation, not only sort of ecosystems that aren't destroyed, but also values that we think are important, right?
Right.
And so that we think in America, we're passing on our democratic traditions, right? Or we're passing on our food traditions to our next generation. So that's, I think that wider frame of sustainability to me is a more accurate one, and I think it then you can build in, you know, things that impact natural systems like food.
Right. Wait for that to go
yeah.
by.
Yeah, this is a busy street. Yeah.
That's all right. Well, great. Thank you. That's very helpful. So the next question sort of gets back to your background, your educational background, and your community that you grew up in. Were you ever involved in any kind of sustainable organization growing up? Or
can I?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can take a break. Okay, so just to sort of repeat the question, growing up and when you were going through your education, were you ever involved in any kind of sustainable organization in your school or in your community?
Well, I do remember the first Earth Day in the Bay Area, going out and cleaning the beaches, and there had been an oil slick, and cleaning up the birds. I do remember that. And then, of course, I always thought of myself as an environmentalist, but I don't know that I was actually involved in, can't think of as being involved. I always feel like nowadays people are do way more service volunteering. When I was a kid, we were pretty self-centered. I don't remember doing any of that. I'm always surprised with my students who come in and they've already saved the world and they're only 18.
So. Right.
Yeah, so sorry, I don't have anything good to say about that issue.
That's great. So, but you were cognizant of things. And
yes, yeah. I mean, that was sort of the early days in the 70s. I remember, I was still in secondary school, primary and secondary school, about, you know, sort of this early Earth Day and people, you know, that awareness of, our impact on the planet, and that we really need to, change how we, relate to the world. And it certainly has, come a long way from there, sort of the anti-littering message, and then, they say the oil slicks in California, and the impact of that on the coastlines.
Right. Disaster outside.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there.
Great. That's fantastic. So part of this program that you've helped to put together has the purpose of building bridges with other activists and organizations. How do you go about doing that?
Okay, so what grew out of this original group humanity's contribution to the Anthropocene was the idea, our group wanted to figure out how we could really collaborate and learn from people in the community. So often universities have this relationship to the community that they're around, or other communities that, you know, we're sort of the experts, we're the people who know stuff, and we're going to go tell you what to do.
Right.
I think that model is really, is wrong and distorts the picture. I think there's a lot of local knowledge out there, a lot of really creative, insightful people out there. The problem is trying to devise processes or procedures to be able to learn from each other, right? So this
right.
idea of kind of collaborative learning, or how it is that we can get people with different, not only different information, but different ways of knowing things too. So the
right.
idea of different epistemologies, and how do we get those people to work on problems together? And so one of the interesting things about something like food and other problems in society is that they're what a lot of academics are now calling kind of wicked problems. And the idea of that is that people come to the problem and sort of think about what the problem is differently. And so when we were just talking about food, we were saying, you know, I mean, there's a problem of you know, food scarcity or food insecurity, and then there's a problem of you know, treatment of workers in the system, where there's problems. So there's all these different problems, and different people are going to think that's kind of the problem of food in America.
Right.
And so one thing is that the idea of wicked problems, you don't have to resolve all those issues. People can come at the problem from different kind of vantage points, but you still could come together and think about it, and you're not going to resolve the problem, but you might, you know, alleviate it, push it down, make it better, and then keep kind of iterating that process and working on it. So that was the idea of trying to design a process by which we could collaborate with people in the community. And I wouldn't want to call them all activists. I mean, some of them are farmers, some of them you know, work in food banks, some of them are people who work for the government, you know
right.
Working in you know, farm policy, some are working on you know, children's access to, you know, food in the school. So I mean, it's the idea is that all these people have expertise, have a vantage point, and are all concerned about the food system. So, mm-hmm. And so part of it is to try to think up a process by which we can learn from one another and try to come to solutions for the food problems of our area.
Great. So is there any maybe techniques or strategies that you use on the ground to reach out to different organizations? Or different activist people?
Well, we've been, you know, reaching out. You know, part of it is, you know, got a few people who are intrigued with the ideas, and they know people,
okay.
And they connect us with other people. So part of it is, or we, you know, there's somebody who does something, and we, you know, think, oh, we should contact that person because we need that sort of perspective or that kind of expertise. And so the idea is sort of just mushrooming out. You know, I hope we're not, you know, leaving any big gaps in the
right.
process. One of the things that I've thought is if we, as we proceed ahead, and we're going to have this event, Dinner 2040, event where we're all going to get together, but I thought that we, you know, that might be a process of iterating that process, right? So that it's not just we do it once and we've, because I don't think we're not going to solve the problem, but the idea that we've set up a process, and we've also made a lot of connections, and they've made connections with each other, so it's not like they have to conduit back through us, but the mm-hmm. point is that we've sort of set up a forum, we've set up a mechanism that people, diverse people from different areas, can sit down and explore the topic together and really listen to each other.
Great, thank you. So why do you think, it sounds like one of the goals is to build a solid network then, sort of an expansive network, to get everybody sort of thinking along the same lines. And why do you think that's important to the future of food? It's sort of a simple question, but what do you think?
So, the problem of food is not going to be solved, it's not going to be solved by the university, and it's not going to be solved by any one person.
Right.
And it's probably not going to be solved permanently anyway, but the point is we can make it better if we have have these different vantage points and these different perspectives. And as I say, some of those perspectives may even see the problem differently, but that's not to say we can't find some sorts of things that we would say, yeah, we ought to work on getting that done and this done. And the point is there are some points that people can see are real problems. And I think getting people to see that they can have a voice and a voice in the system is really going to go a long way to changing the system, because I think people feel pretty disempowered.
Right. So that brings up another question then, because it seems like with this network and with all the involvement, that people might have different priorities of what problems the biggest, what should we solve now, what can we solve now.
Yeah.
So how do you decide how to go about that? How do you identify which problem to address? And if there's an order, how do you decide on that order?
No, that's a good question. So what we decided to do was to focus on 25 years out. Rather than looking at all the problems of the food system, which we can name, you know, hundreds of them, you know, and we kind of know a lot of them, why don't we, as a group, envision what we'd like it to look like in 25 years? Like, what would we like it to look like? Now, I think that people would agree that we need to kind of have these values that I set out as guiding, you know, kind of parameters, right? But what do we want it to look like? I mean, how do we want it to function? So there's all these kind of details about. So let's kind of play around with that idea of envisioning dinner 2040. That's our idea. It's like, let's look at what the food system would look like. What dinner would we eat in 2040? And then the idea is to. So we're going. The idea is to engage in this kind of process that's referred to as a charrette, where you you do what's called backcasting. So the idea is you want to get someplace in 25 years. What would you have to have in place 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you know, and so on, right? Because you don't get, it's like you want to be a brain surgeon. You don't, you know, just get there. You
right.
go, oh, first of all, I've got to get an undergraduate degree, and then I've got it right. I mean, so you have your end and go, and you could map out what are all the steps you have to do, you know, including a fellowship and a da da da. Right. So the idea is that you would do something like that. Now, of course, so that's the basic idea, is that you get people to see, okay, we're not going to get there tomorrow, but what can we do to get on the path.
Right.
And what are those steps? Now, that is a complicated issue. I'm not saying it's easy.
Right.
But I think it gets people, first of all, seeing that, you know, change doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
But change does happen if you start it.
Right.
And you also start to see, you know, how things could get in place in a few years, and then how that would allow you to get to the next step and the next step.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that still doesn't address, you know, sort of priorities. Some things may fall out that in order to have one thing happen, we have to change a law.
Right.
Or we have to get a distribution network with some refrigerated trucks to get food that would spoil to poor people. Or we have to, right. So there are some things that we might come to. So the point is not to come to a kind of, you know, big consensus on everything, but rather to see that there are that people, even people who are in diverse areas, can they might hear, you know, an issue that you think is really important. Hey, I didn't know about that issue.
Right.
I didn't know that was happening.
Right.
Yeah, we ought to think about how to resolve that. So some of it is, you know, kind of consciousness raising, just learning about, you know, what some of the issues are, and then how we start to solve them. So, we're not going to, you know, this little event isn't going to change everything, but part of, is seeing that we need to have processes like this in place if we're going to make real change.
Right. And so you talked about sort of obstacles or challenges that could come up. Can you identify any specific challenges that you've already come up against in regards to food sustainability?
Well, there are, you know, like a lot of problems, there are, you know, entrenched economic incentives, you know, in place. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, you don't have to, you know, vilify, you know, big companies necessarily. But the point is, those are powerful forces. And they're hard to change, right?
Right.
It's sort of like you've got a big cruise liner and you're trying to turn it around, right? And people say this about big ag in America, you know, mm-hmm. industrial agriculture. It's a big thing to turn around, right? And that's where, you know, you may not have to, you know, you're not going to do all that. Mm-hmm. But if you can start to do smaller things, you know, bigger change comes from small change, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think if you think you have to, you know, change the whole thing, well, that is, for one thing, that's not how change happens, right?
Okay.
I mean, it does happen by people showing a different way, other people getting interested in it, and you know, so I think, but you know, the food industry has become a big business, and it's become a big global business, and mm-hmm. so if a community wants to change it, you really, you know, so you're up against those kinds of things, so that seems to me a big issue. I mean, there are a lot of challenges, you know, and that's, you know, I mean, it may be, and of course, what I'm coming at it, I mean, I'm a philosopher, I'm in the humanities, and this whole project and this idea was that is trying to keep it in people's minds that these are not solely technical problems, right? To keep it in people's mind that food is more than just a technical problem, right?
Right.
And I think that we got sort of sidetracked in our food system when we started looking at it just as a kind of science problem. You know, look at all the food we're producing, you know, producing all these calories. But look what the result was.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to seeing food as connected up with culture and meaning and place and all those other things that, you know, that the way we all experience food.
Right.
Sure. We don't experience it. I mean, maybe there's a few, you know, kind of nutty athletes who, you know, just think about when they're just, you know, taking their protein powder or something to think about it. But most of us think about food for taste and experience and sitting with people and eating food and, you know, all the other kinds of joys of food in our lives.
Right. Okay. Great. So that brings us now to the project that we've sort of been referring to
mm-hmm.
throughout the interview, which is the Dinner 2040.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us what that is specifically?
Yeah. So this is the project that grew out of our project here at ASU, and the idea of it is to take, you know, humanists and other, you know, artists, and then with community people in the food system in various ways, everything from farmers to food bank workers to legislators to, you know, all the people that impact the food system, and get them together to envision what our food system should look like in 25 years. And so we've planned an event in November in which we'll have people come out to an urban farm that will have the event, and we're going to have people at different tables, and there'll be mixed tables of people representing different aspects of the food system, and there'll be a humanist there, and we'll really work through this idea of, you know, first kind of envisioning together as a group what we want to see. And of course, along the way with that envisioning, people are often going to bring up, you know, things that what's wrong with this system. but part of it is to, you know, to have that kind of spilling out of ideas. They talk about faucet thinking, so you just sort of get the ideas out and don't sort of overthink it.
Right.
And then the idea is to go through another couple of steps. You know, one might look at, you know, what are some of the challenges to getting there, And then finally, what steps can we take to get there? And sort of thinking about that backcasting idea of, you know, what do we need to do now? What do we need to do in 5 years? And so the idea is that you, as a group, kind of work through, you know, what are some of the things that we could do to start on that road to getting to that envisioned place. So we see this as an idea of, we mentioned sort of consciousness raising, kind of learning from one another, you know, sharing the, you know, what people's views about the problem are, you know, and what some of the challenges are, but then also, you know, really thinking together about how we make change and how we, you know, make a more positive food system going forward.
Right. So how long would you say that you and the other people involved, how long have you been working on this?
Well, we've been working on it actually a couple of years now. As I say, we started out by doing this as part of this larger project, and then we actually held a charrette a couple of years ago and brought in some community, work with some community members, some local farmers, and we went through the charrette process and we developed meals that we would eat in 2040. So there we were sort of focused on what would a meal look like, and we found the process really worked. It was very evocative, and you know, allowed people to work together in a really constructive way and develop interesting solutions.
Okay. What was the decision, or what was the reasoning behind the 25 years? Why 2040?
Well, so, yeah, so why 25 years? I mean, if you think, when you're talking about sustainability, one of the challenges of talking about sustainability is, what scale are we talking about? Sometimes people talk about scales. If you talk to people that work in nuclear power, for example, they're often talking, I mean, nuclear waste will be around for, you know, I mean, they talk about things like 10,000 years,
right.
You know, 20,000 years that waste will still be there. That's a kind of scale that I think is so out of human framework that I don't think it's very productive to talk in those very large scales of time. Often people refer to that as kind of geological time as opposed to human time. So thinking about it, since I'm a moral philosopher, I mean, you know, and trying to think of what is it that can motivate people morally to act in certain ways, I think we're morally motivated when we can sort of connect emotionally and to some degree intellectually. We can understand, you know, what things would be like, and we also feel like we can kind of emotionally connect. That I think the 25-year frame, you know, is a framework that makes sense in that way. You know, it's our children, maybe it's our grandchildren, depending on, you know, but I mean, the point is and it's us, right? I mean,
right.
A lot of us feel like we'll still be around in 25 years. Some people maybe not. But the point is, you don't feel like it's something that you won't experience. And so,
right.
Or your kids won't experience. And I think another aspect of this, and this is something I'm learning from my history colleagues, is that looking back 25 years from now, our food system that we have now was created by policies that were put in place 25 years ago. Right. So it has. So there is an effect on where we are now from what happened 25 years ago.
Right.
So, and this is where history comes in, right, is that you can see that, you know, what we do now really is going to impact us going forward. Like what policy decisions we make, how we treat the soil, how we treat our water supply, what we do with migrant labor. I mean, all these things, we had policies 25 years ago and got us in this situation. And so what we do now. So 25 years has a lot of, I think, resonance in that way. And there really is a kind of historical argument for thinking in that kind of a chunk of time.
Great. So it sounds like the Dinner 2040 project has sort of a practicality to it. So a lot of times when you hear about environmental movements or environmental projects, the critique is that it's just unreasonable. Is that sort of an intent that you had and the other folks that helped you start this, is that you wanted to have a very practical outlook, something that people could relate to?
Yeah, I think that some environmentalists have put themselves so far out in terms of human concerns that they often, I mean, I think one of the ways in which the idea of the, you know, radical environmentalists came up is because there were, you know, some people claiming that they'd rather, you know, save a rattlesnake rather than a human or something. So it's sort of that right. idea that, you know, humans are kind of parasitic on the environment. And as I say, that seems to me not accurate and not and also not pragmatic.
Right.
I mean, if we want to see real change in how we protect and conserve the environment, then we need to see that we're part of that environment. Humans are part of that environment, and we live here, and so we need to figure out ways to have a kind of ethic about that use. And so,
right.
You know, one of the reasons that, you know, I'm always attracted to Aldo Leopold's work is that he talks, you know, about the land ethic, and it really is a, you know, he was focused to a large extent on how farmers and other people who use the land, how they use the land, and
right.
saw them as major conservationists. So so it's not about just preserving wilderness, and again, against wilderness, but I think
right.
we would do a lot more for the environment if we figured out systems for taking care of the land we use.
Right. So so you're trying to involve not just like humanists and academic folks, but also people who maybe use the land as a way of life, whereas, you know, many humanists and academics sort of see the land as either a recreational thing or sometimes a religious thing or spiritual thing, but you're trying to add a practical element to it to involve as many people as possible. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think we need to. You know, in focusing on a land ethic, we need to not only think about preserving, you know, wild areas for recreation, a spiritual renewal, you know, and even, you know, biodiversity, but rather that we need to think about those environments in which we inhabit. And that, you know, of course, we, you know, I mean, you know, humans always inhabited wilderness. I mean, this is sort
sure.
of the mythology that was, you know, I mean, native people lived there. So it wasn't like without people. But that became
right.
the kind of, you know, a kind of mythical view that you know, the sort of colonists got onto and, of course, pushed native people out so they could preserve wilderness, right?
Right.
Rather than seeing that those people lived in those environments. But we live, you know, so there's wilderness, and then there's also, of course, you know, agrarian landscapes. We have, you know, farmers and ranchers using the land. We have suburban landscapes. We have urban landscapes, and this kind of whole continuum of landscapes, most of which, or all of which, we're in,
mm-hmm.
right, except for, you know, maybe Antarctica or something. But so so we need to think about the land ethic in all those contexts, right?
Right.
We need to think about urban environments and how we can use those in responsible ways, including, I think, you know, more and more people are talking about having food systems, growing food in those urban environments as well as suburban environments. Again, you know, how can we integrate food systems into our built environments? And then all the way out to agrarian contexts and ranch contexts.
Great. Thank you. Tell me about your role in Dinner 2040.
Okay, well, I maybe became sort of the unwitting leader of the group, which I'm not really, but I don't know how it, you know, but anyway, so I, you know, and it was an intriguing idea. I mean, I'm a philosopher, so I don't necessarily do a lot of community work, although I've enjoyed what we've done so far, and I've actually learned a lot from getting to know farmers and policymakers and people that are working in the food system. So I'm already feel like I'm a beneficiary of this process because I have a committee of people I'm working with, and we also had that first charrette. And so I really have learned a lot, and it's taught me that, you know, the academy needs to open up and really figure out processes where we can get the community engaged in the research, not just in the way we sometimes do it, where it's kind of bring one community member in and then not really listen to them, but really see them as having a kind of knowledge that is important and that we can learn from, and that, you know, we probably have something to contribute to. But the point is, we can really learn from one another. And so so I sort of ended up sort of the leader of this group. And then I started thinking about these values and sort of was able to kind of articulate those five values, because as a moral philosopher, I think about values. So and I thought that it makes sense to get people to see that their food system, and we often talk about when you make consumer choices, that there's a value behind that. You may not know it, but try to get people to often articulate what they're doing when they do it. And that, and I think in this way, I'd like to have people, when they think about the food system, to recognize the values involved in it. So if you buy a... there's more and more attention to how animals are raised. You buy, products that are, raised in a way that the animals are treated cruelly. I mean, you should recognize that, you're part of that process now, right? And you can choose to do otherwise, right? Or if you, and even, you know, things like organic food, I mean, organic, and there's a big debate whether it's better for you or not. I think it's pretty clear it's better for the environment. So right. You don't want to get into whether it's better for you. It's better for the soil. It's better for the environment. So sure. So you might buy it on that ground. You might say, right. Hey, it's a little more expensive, but I want to participate. So the point is that you're using your dollars to express your values. And so so that was my role, or has been, to really try to keep those value front and center. Mm-hmm. And it's not a hard sell. I just think it's people haven't thought about it. They haven't thought that there's all these values floating around with right. what they eat and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So why would you say Dinner 2040 is important to the community?
Well, I think communities, and we're going to do this in Phoenix, but and I think other communities should do something similar, that it's important that the community get engaged in what their food system looks like, and also get empowered to make the change, right?
Right.
And because I think there's a lot of feeling dissatisfied and feeling like it's a bit out of control and it's not what they want for them or their kids or even their communities. And I think that this process will have, that one outcome of just having people recognize that there is a role that they can play. And that can be, there's obviously multiple things that might mean.
Right.
But the point is, you're not... That you can have a can be empowered in the system.
Great. So you said that this is sort of, this project is centered on Phoenix. Is that
mm-hmm. what we were doing was or are doing? I guess you'd say is we like to think of this process of Dinner 2040 as a kind of template or a model. So what we're hoping is that other communities will take it on. We've had a few communities kind of say they were going to do it, so we're hoping that they will.
Great.
And that the idea is that other communities would say, hey, let's look at our food system. Let's get together, some humanists, some artists, some farmers, some policy, all the people that you think you ought to have at that meeting.
Yeah.
And have them get together and go through this process. And again, we're trying to make it a kind of positive process of envisioning the future and then talking about how we get there.
Great. Are you aware of any other communities or any other places in the country that are doing something similar, or is this unique to...
I think that there are places talking about the future of food. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anybody doing it, sort of establishing a kind of date and then, but people are kind of talking more generally about the future of food. Some of that is more kind of writ large. I know at Johns Hopkins they're doing a project. It's kind of designing the future global food system, or kind of at a much more kind of global level.
Wow.
I know the guy that's working on that, but I am pretty convinced now that though there are more national and international issues, I think that there's an importance in getting communities engaged and making sure that there are kind of community solutions. And I don't think that every solution that would be, that we shouldn't universalize the solution, right?
Right.
Because then otherwise you run over culture and history, you run over place-based ecological differences,
right?
So the problem is that when we do that, when we import certain foods to grow here that worked in the Midwest, they're great in the Midwest, you got lots of water there, you got a whole different soil composition, blah, blah, blah. But so I think we have to be careful about that idea of scalability or taking a solution that works in one place and doing it in another place. So the degree to which this is scalable, it's that the template could work other places, that we could take it and other communities could use it, and that then that starts them on a process of planning,
right?
And that's what really this is about.
Great. And you said that some other communities are sort of paying attention to this.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing?
Because we had people from around the country who were part of our group, and I think one is Eugene, Oregon, and a town in Illinois which I can't think of where the University of Illinois is.
It's
embarrassing. I can't remember what it is.
Is it Urbana?
It might be Urbana. Anyway, well, yeah.
Somewhere in Illinois.
Yeah, somewhere.
That's right.
And then I thought another one of our group was in Taiwan, and in Taiwan they were thinking about taking it on. So we haven't really made a big push to get it out there. I think as we go forward, we would, and in particular once we do ours, then we can kind of push that out through social media. Our idea was to almost see if communities might take it on as a kind of challenge, to have their community do it too, and then post their results and sort of.
Okay.
And so part of this is that we'd like to have a website and where we could post, our outcomes, but also our ongoing efforts, but also then if other communities were doing it, we could post their results as well.
Great, fantastic. So just expanding that network then a little bit.
Yeah, and through social networks and so on, we could push out the idea. I mean, that's part of it, is just getting people to hear about it and know about it.
Great. So the last one, the last question is sort of a personal question, but what does Dinner 2040 mean to you? You can handle this any way you want.
Well, I mean, it started out as a kind of academic exercise. We were part of an academic group on a project, and we were talking about multiple epistemologies, and we were talking about all kinds of highfalutin stuff. And now it's become very, community engaged, and a lot of people are excited about it. And so it's really, for me, it's been a kind of personal journey of, you know, meeting people in the food system in the valley and hearing about their stories and hearing about their excitement around this idea. And so, you know, that's been kind of personally gratifying that we've sort of pushed, you know, put this out there, and it seems to be resonating. We have chefs interested in working with us on it. We have people who want to come and want to participate in it. So it's kind of developed into something that resonates with people. And I think it's partly there's something kind of evocative about the idea of thinking about dinner in 25 years, and also thinking about, you know, our role in making something good happen. And again, I think there's something about thinking about the positive and how we attain sustainability rather than focusing on all the things that's wrong with our system.
Right.
And in a way, it doesn't give you a kind of vision of where we want to go. So I think this has been something that I didn't really expect to be that enticing, but it's turned out to be. In fact, a group of us through GEOS, through the Food Systems Transformation Initiative, went to Africa to work with young African agricultural entrepreneurs, a few hundred of them, and I ran a workshop there and did this process with them. And it was very fascinating because, you know, getting them to think in their context, and these are, you know, young people who have ideas either to be farmers or somehow or other in the agricultural chain, you know, supply chain, that they think about where they want their food system to be in 25 years. And they have, you know, you think of challenges, I mean, you know, real challenges, but it was a really engaged conversation. We had about 60 of them at different tables working together, and again, it was they you know, they really got energized thinking about where they wanted to go and be in 25 years, and then it got them thinking about what they could do to get there, right? How they could see their role in it. And and so it was kind of exciting to see this idea work, you know, in an entirely different context.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for all this.
Sure.
And
thank you.
Yeah.